Basically, it was a challenge for me to decide what to talk about, and I decided to talk about things that are like on the drawing table. And I realized that I'm basically opening myself for a lot of criticism, but I actually like that idea. You guys really go at me.
let's start with being present.
What do you mean you're going to tell us about stuff that's not complete?
Well, it's basically on the drawing board. It's not even complete. Even I don't understand it. So, you know. So it's somewhat challenging. Maybe you will help me understand it. That's my agenda. But I will start from something. Well, let me actually announce what I'll be talking about. So four things are on the agenda, and I will talk about something called sparse and incomplete representations first.
Oh, I know.
Then I will switch over to something called primacy that Dima Rindberg was talking about before. I think he gave two talks, both in kind of conference and on the workshop. So primacy and receptor and olfactory receptor is evolution. This will be basically an easy part. What are the implications of primacy coding for the particular, you know, response of olfactory receptor? And whether it's a testable thing or not. Then I'll talk about duality theory and constraint optimization. So it'll be basically a very brief introduction to the duality theory. I realize that, well, you may have some kind of rusty memories about it.
How
many kids? No, constraint optimization.
How many kids?
And finally, I'll talk about duality in olfactory coding. So, basically, this stuff has been published in 2011 or so, and, you know, maybe even earlier. So it's a very old stuff. So just depending on your interest, you know, just gauge the level of your criticism. I mean, it's so old that I think Martin is going to say that it's actually wrong. So, you know, if somebody says the theory is wrong, by definition, it's very old. And then yeah, I guess it's maybe it's sufficient but not necessary, or something like that. Okay. Sparse and complete representation.
What do you mean the theory is wrong?
So, I mean, many people have already suggested that some resemblance of overcomplete problem with L1 minimization is solved by olfactory system. And, like, to define the problem, I mean, I think maybe five speakers here, you know, Vijay included, you know, everybody talked about that. There is a possibility that olfactory system splits, at least tries to estimate the vector of concentrations, right? So you have y, let's call it yj, equals to the sum over I, aij. Aji, xi, where, so basically the idea that these are the responses of olfactory receptors. And this is a vector of concentrations. And, well, vector of concentrations basically includes all the smells in the universe or all the smells that in the environment that animal can be exposed to. So it's a huge vector. So the problem, this linear system looks like this. Right, so, and y is about 1,000 dimensional. So there are about 1,000 receptors. And there is probably about a million of different components of smell that can be present in the environment. But the good news, and this is the affinity matrix, this is X, the concentration vector, and every entry in the, every component of the concentration vector is supposed to represent the, whether, what is the concentration of the smell present in the environment. Okay, so it's the input-output relationship for the receptors. But the good news, as many have suggested, is that this vector is very sparse. So, for example, it's k-sparse. So despite the fact that this is hugely underdetermined system, you have only 1,000 Ys that you know that the nervous system can measure, and you have probably several hundred thousand Xs. You still can solve it just by virtue of it being sparse. There's not much information in those axes, right? So, I mean, I hope this is all, it has been talked about before. What I will talk...
Number 10 to the 6.
10 to the 6?
Yeah, that's...
It's a ballpark estimate. It's not really important because it's in the logarithm. So if you make an error by, say, two orders of magnitude, you get like a 10%.
You worry it's bigger or smaller?
Smaller.
Smaller?
Number of volatile molecules?
Well, these are the number of things you want to identify. You don't identify volatile molecules, right?
But the setup of this problem, but the setup of this problem is that the input problem is that there's a certain number of volatile molecules. You can later talk about whether you care about that at all. You may not.
It exists.
It exists. Right.
Yeah. No, but the point is, you're not trying to figure out the components of that.
Well, no, no, you are not. That's my, that's the point of my talk. I will talk, I mean, however, that, I mean, it's a twisted answer. There is a twisted answer to this question. So I will argue now that granule cells actually solve this problem. And, you know, but because granule cells are silent, they are not communicating this information to anything other than mitral cells. So that solution is getting lost in translation. So that's what I'm going to argue. So to say that nervous system doesn't identify components, I wouldn't say that. But whether it is actually used in identifying the smell, I don't think so. Therefore, the duality theory comes into play.
Also, another nice thing of starting in this way, even if you don't necessarily assume that the brain particularly cares about all these detailed million concentrations, is that unlike the discussions of, you know, what are the dimensions of perceptual space, at least, you know, this vector, we know what we're talking about. It may be that you don't actually care about the details of it, but you know what
exactly
it is.
Exactly. So this is the ultimate truth, right? So this is how the smell is out there. The question is if you care about it or not.
It's a separate issue. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, if you added, like, time component, that would be probably a complete description of
How clear is this? Is this a linear relationship, actually?
It's an excellent question. It is actually, for my purpose, it's actually a very good approximation for the purposes of my talk. The reason why is because, like in some very general model for receptor binding, receptor response, like a factory receptor, neuron response, will be, say, of number j, will be a nonlinear function of y, j, which could, of course, be linear. I mean, the idea is that there is a model, a simple model for olfactory receptor, in which what olfactory receptor does is basically, if it has a single binding site, it will just compute y, j, and then it will compute a nonlinear function of it. So there is a model. Of course, there are many complications, like, for example, different components may have different cooperative properties, you know. There may be several binding sites, so there are a lot of things on top of it. But because the primacy theory, which will be the bulk of my talk, is non-parametric, so it doesn't really care about the absolute values. It only cares about relationship, like which one is bigger than which. Just by virtue of this function B monotonically increasing. I mean, if this function is monotonically increasing, I can only care about y's, because if I only care about the relation, the relative response, it's not absolute values.
Another thing is that even if the actual transformation is not linear, which in general isn't, Yeah. You know, you can use the L1 thing at least to put bounds on how decodable the signal is.
Yeah.
Right? To just see how much information is there. In the same sense that people use ideal observer analyses and stuff.
Yeah.
A different kind of sort of bounding kind of relation of the capacity of the representation. That's a useful thing to know at least.
I think also it's possible that you can solve the nonlinearity problem by including more dictionary elements.
Sure.
So for every set of concentrations, like separate set of dictionary elements, which would somehow blow up the X vector, but you know, it would still work. So, so how do we solve this problem? And you know, the compressed sensing teaches us that we need to minimize the L1 norm, and then we can actually recover X given Y, despite the fact that it's incomplete, it's underdetermined system, right? So what we need to do is we find X as a minimum of some measure, some parsimony constraint. Under the condition that Y is equal to AX. Okay? Right, so, I mean, this is kind of a difficult, like, how do you implement constraint? It's kind of a difficult topic. How about if I actually find sort of approximation to this problem, and I say that X is equal to arch mean of some function fh of X, where no constraint here, right? But h of X is equal to the same thing, sum over I xi times coefficient theta times some some parameter theta plus 1/2 norm of y minus ax squared. Right. So when this parameter theta goes to zero, what happens is that this will be less important than this, right? If theta goes to zero. So you will actually enforce the constraint first. And when you enforce the constraint, there are actually several solutions of X that are compatible with the constraint. You will then optimize that set of solutions that is consistent with the constraint to find the actual X. So when theta goes to zero, solution of this problem approaches solution of this problem. That's the idea. So it's basically an asymptotic property.
So Alex, are you, two questions, are you forcing xi non-negative? You're about to do that?
Well, I could. Because I mean, if it's the correct solution, it will find it automatically. I don't need to. I could do it as well, right? I could say that X
is... No, I mean, it's... So certainly if theta goes to zero, you're going to find there may be... There is a solution with all the X's non-zero, right?
Yeah.
But there are multiple solutions. And can you have some of the X's negative and have some of the X's smaller? There are lots of solutions to this, right?
Yeah. I guess my line of thinking, I mean, it's a very good question, and I didn't really think about it very much. But my way of thinking of it is that if I find the correct solution using this problem, the axis will be positive. And therefore, I shouldn't care about negativity.
I don't think there's any guarantee. There's a huge, I mean, A is a huge null space, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we know that X's are positive, right?
Yeah, yeah. So we know that there are positive X's satisfied. It's assuming that it's... Yeah, I don't know.
So the granule cells actually... Well, I'll argue that granule cells can solve this problem with the constraint that X is positive. Yeah, so...
Because in your neuron paper, you actually explicitly had the X is non-negative, right?
Yes. Right, so the granule cell thing, many of you actually know better than I what we did. So So now the idea is that the you can actually make this possible by like solving this problem possible by a network, right? So like there are two things. The reason why I'm talking about it is twofold. Like one of them is to say that once you have a functional of this sort, you can actually see the network that implements it. So there is a relationship between the cost function and the network. And the relationship was basically followed, was invented by Holfeld, I think, right, in his networks, through by computing a Lebanon function for a network. So this is like, this is old stuff and it's boring. The only point which I'm trying to make is that you can, if you see a functional, you can see what the what is the network that implements this functional, it minimizes this functional, right? So the idea goes back to Holfeld. Right, so you have mitral cells that send things to cortex and other areas. They receive inputs from the glomeruli. The inputs are called YJs. There are also granule cells. There are several million of them, quite conveniently matching the number of potential components. So the granule cells connect to the mitral cells through the dendritic synapses. I'm going to call responses of granule cells XI. And the weights.
Not a coincidence?
The weights, coincidentally, are positive in one direction and negative in the other direction, inhibitory in the other direction. And I'm going to call the weight from I to J. So it's from the mitral cell number J to the granule cell number I. That will be positive. It will be AIJ. No, actually, I called it like this. JI. And then the reverse weight, I'm going to assume that it's symmetric, right? So WJI is going to be minus AJI. So it's symmetric, but with the opposite sign. So, and then this will be called the response of mitral cells. Cell will be EJ. And.
Sorry, WIJ is now synapse from granule to mitral?
So the IJ. This is a synapse from granule number I to mitral number J. And it's negative, and it's, but it's the same as the forward synapse. So then I can write a system of equations for this network, and I'll say that.
Sorry, what's EJ? I missed EJ.
EJ is the response of the mitral cell. Okay.
E for error.
So EJ, exactly. EJ is equal to YJ minus the sum over. So because granule cells obviously are inhibitory, the sum over granule cells AJI times XI. Right, so it's basically the sum of the excitatory input that mitral cell receives from the glomerulus minus the sum of all responses of the granule cells combined with weights, minus because it's an inhibitory connection. And then For the granule cell, I'll write the dynamical equation. I'll actually write the equation for the voltage or for the input of the mitral cell, of the granule cell. Say VI dot plus VI equals to, so there will be some kind of delay, will be equal to plus. I mean, things with plus, right? Because it receives only excitatory input from the mitral cell. Sum over J A J I. EJ and V is the voltage of the granule cell or the total input that it receives and then the actual response of the granule cell will be related through a nonlinear function to VJ. So XI is a function of VI, and I mean, the reason why it makes sense to introduce this nonlinear function is because the response of granule cells are very sparse, so many of them have no response to smell. Therefore, you would want to have this feature that you have something fall below threshold, not respond. So, so F, the function F, I'll just draw it here, Vi, Xi, function F is a threshold linear, say with slope G, with slope G, which would be just a. So that's what we used in this 2011 paper. And then if you do it, if you do now of equations, which is difficult really to understand, but if you compute the Lyapunov for this system of equations, you can actually do it using the Hopfield prescription. You know, you will get the you'll get basically something very, very close to H, right? So H, Lyapunov function.
So is it true if you had the dynamics for the microcell also, could it be that you don't have a Lyapunov function anymore because...
No, you do have Lyapunov function.
But you can have oscillations, just E,
yes.
Gamma kind of oscillations.
Yes.
I don't see how that goes to the Lyapunov function.
Well, it will just go on the iso surface of the Lyapunov function. I don't know.
That's
a good question. Well,
I mean, the Lyapunov function, if it's strictly decreasing, you can't have oscillations, right?
Mm-hmm. Well,
definitely you have a Hamiltonian kind of component.
It may actually be like slowly going down in a circle. I mean, I think oscillations.
No, but you can have real, you know, just straightforward periodic orbits in this thing when E also has dynamics and if the time scales are right. I mean, I don't think it's important. I was just curious.
I think if you introduce dynamics into mitral cells, you'll only get decaying oscillations.
In simulations, you don't.
You don't?
Well, you can have, yeah, you don't have to be. Okay.
I mean, just take one E and one V and just have an alpha half-life location there. It's not, I don't want to interrupt. I was just wondering.
I mean, the cases that I analyzed with dynamics in mitral cells, you can get oscillations indeed, but they are decaying, which means that you do have a Lyapunov function, but you cycle down in a spiral. So it's a focal point, or whatever it's called. But I mean, maybe we'll discuss it. It's a good point. So, the Lyapunov function h of x and the dynamics will be that v dot, vi dot is equal to minus dh over dxi. So it's a sort of formal gradient descent of the Lyapunov function and then h of x is actually what I wrote there. So it's actually equal to theta sum over I xi. Of course, x has to be bigger or equal than 0 in this case because, you know, it's the firing rate of the cell, so it cannot fall below 0. So I don't need to worry about the absolute value. Plus 1 half some absolute value of y minus ax squared and plus 1 over 2g sum over I xi squared. So the only difference that you get is this last term from this functional that you need, which you can actually kill. You can kill the last term by assuming that the gain of granule cells is very high. Of course, there are limits to which you can push the gain because it will start oscillating, but will start producing ripples that you don't see really in experiment.
Alex, I'm sorry to rewind to talk to an earlier point. I think I've missed why it is you said that we should try to solve the problem or why the problem of the minimum of h of x is easier than the L1. Or why did you introduce this second?
I'm just arguing that there is a component of the network that is solving for this problem. And another argument that I'm trying to make is that if you have a network can can actually optimize some function, you know, which is kind of trivial. I want to make this point across that. And if you look at some cost function, you can actually understand what the network, what is the network that is needed to solve this cost function. And in principle, I mean, this term can do a lot of damage and a lot of different things, which you may think that they're interesting. You know, in the 2011 paper, we're stuck with the assuming that the gain is very high, so you can disregard the linear component, which it becomes just L1, straight L1 minimization, with, you know, with a positivity constraint. So another cool stuff that you can do with this is, I mean, this kind of network is very old. I mean, I think Holzhausen and Field were like looking at networks like this first. Yes?
For the question, so suppose you want to use a network like this to solve a minimization problem like this, how long does it take? I'm trying to compare the time scales at which you're supposed to sniff and then you're supposed to do something.
I mean, it's a convex problem, so it just goes down the gradient, so there's no problem solving it.
Right, but still, how long does it take? I mean, are we...
The computer? I don't know.
No. I mean, I'm, one might even hope that this kind of thing actually is really what is happening.
Yeah.
In which case, how long...
That's what my hope is. You know.
Right.
But...
So how long does it take?
It's feasible to find a sort of...
Look, how many iterations through the network it would take to come to a reasonable...
I don't know. I mean, it's straightforward, and I did obviously simulate those equations and it finds a solution. I just don't know how to compare it to biological time, you know.
But you do know, like, how many did you count? Can you count the number of iterations?
It's a time. It's a continuous time, right? So it just goes down because it's a function. Everything is a function of time, you know.
It's not related at all to the time constant of. That you put for the granular dynamics?
Oh, how many time constants? I mean, it's a few time constants. It's not exponential. It's maybe like 100 time constants.
Gotcha. Really, the kind of question I'm asking is, you sniff, and then your behaviors can be triggered with a certain time of when you sniff,
yeah.
And this takes, you know, probably a couple of synaptic iterations. And just trying to compare, you know, how many hundreds of milliseconds this would take to get to an approximate solution versus triggering behaviors, that's all. And the answer
it's
is...
It's a good question. I mean, it's basically several time constants. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe
so it's not unreasonable compared to the biological.
Not completely unreasonable. Yeah. So, I mean, the point here is, though, that this representation is not sent anywhere because there is no projections from granule cells, so
sure.
Just contained within the population of granule cells, and then we made a big deal by saying that mitral cells actually send the errors of those representations. So therefore, I use the letter E. You see that the mitral cell response is the input minus the representation, right? So it's actually an error term. So mitral cells are error neurons, according to this AD. You know? That's the only kind of logic. Another logic, actually, that you can propose here is that mitral cells will be active very briefly after the order onset because you need to get the inhibitory currents going. So before the inhibition kicks in, the mitral cells will transmit the entirety of the information. And during that brief, maybe that only that brief snippet of information is enough to figure out what the smell is, you know? So that's another possibility, is that the role of granule cells is to temporarily pattern responses of mitral cells and make them more temporarily sparse.
So that's basically happens in our network, except we feed we get feedback in the granule cells.
Yeah.
So the granule cells are also supported by the cortex. But everything happens, like you say, the mitral cell activity goes up, and then it gets explained away, and it goes away, and the information goes transferred into the cortex.
Yeah. I think the network which I'll be proposing is very close to your network as well, for the cortex. So we'll need to somehow find the differences. Anyway, so that's why I'm talking about it, just to figure out what the differences between different networks are, predictions. So another cool stuff that you can do with this is, well, I mean, if you think that this is cool, you can actually implement learning. And learning is very straightforward. what you say is that, so you have this functional age, which is optimized. I'm arguing that it's optimized by activities of granule cells, but you can also optimize it with respect to A, affinity matrix vectors, affinity matrix or vectors or dictionary elements in the affinity matrix. And by doing so, you will actually learn the dictionary, right? You will learn the vector of affinities. I mean, nobody tells you when you are born what those affinities are, right? So you're exposed to a bunch of smells. So the idea is that you can compute, you can figure out what the learning rule is for here, Aij dot, the time derivative, right? So it's equal to minus some learning rate, derivative of H over Aij. And when you do it, when you compute this derivative, I mean, only one term here depends on A. You will get eta EI EJ XI.
Sorry, what is the learning rule supposed to do? It's supposed to improve what?
It's supposed to learn the dictionary, learn the affinity matrix. So the way it's defined, it will minimize the error of representation. You know, that's what it's doing. And to minimize the error of representation, I mean, I understand that you don't like this idea. You think that A's are random. But maybe you will consider... Sorry.
No, I'm schizophrenic. I work on two different kinds of projects, which do two different
things.
Absolutely. Every target, you can see which one hits.
Yeah,
exactly.
And the other,
it doesn't matter.
The first one, then the second one, the first one's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, go for it.
Right. So maybe you want to minimize over the, as a function of exposure to the smell, you want to minimize the the set of dictionary elements. So to minimize the error. Sorry, to minimize the error, to optimize the set of dictionary elements. And of course, I need to actually compute, put an average here, which would be over the set of smells to which the animal is exposed, right, in the environment. So, and the same here. The remarkable...
So, Alex, are you thinking this generalization evolutionary, or...?
I'm thinking as a function of exposure to the smells, not evolutionary. But I wouldn't rule out evolution as well, either, should I say. Because, I mean, it's possible that there are some constraints which are imposed evolutionary as well.
You're using A primarily as for the affinity, right?
Yes. So the question is, how does it know the affinity matrix? How does it know it?
So A is, the point is really is, A is the actual affinities in the world.
Okay.
And this A is, and that is an A that shows up.
Exactly.
And the network's got to learn the affinities in the world. So it's a little,
it's a different A.
It's actually different.
Yes,
A.
I think that's interesting.
So EJ was the response.
Let me say.
EJ was mitral cell response?
Yeah.
Yes. So to make at this point more clear, so there is a set of affinities which is real, which relates concentration vector to responses of receptor. And there are weights, right? And those are two different entities. Mm-hmm. So these are basically binding affinities between other instances and receptors, and those are network components. So how do network components learn this stuff?
They just happen to have the same name.
I call them the same name to make it maybe easier to understand, but now I see that it was a mistake. So if I call them W, this would be the learning rate for the W.
Yep, that makes
you
sense.
Know, in the course of exposure to the smells, the Ws would be adjusted to minimize the error of representation.
So what was the question?
Yeah, I guess Vijay raised an excellent point, is that the learning rule turned out to be local, which means that it only relates two smells that are in direct contact to each other, which is mitral and granule cell. And that is actually a consequence of dendrodendritic synapses. So this learning theory, the argument why you have dendrodendritic synapses is to be able to learn the affinity matrix using local, which is like biologically plausible. I mean, if you can apply the term biologically plausible to this, then, you know. So that is great. So basically, you can explain why you have dendritic synapses, so you can learn components of smells and dictionary.
I didn't see that fast enough. So this
as it's written, it implies the learning is both in the exciter and in the inhibitor component. Is that important?
It's assumed that they're similar. They're adjusting to be correlated.
Right, but some kind of mechanism. Is that important? Could you keep the inhibitory part fixed and only learn the excitatory part?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good point. Probably can't see it better than I at this point. But I was assuming that the synapse has some kind of mechanism that will adjust components. So, if, for example, if synaptic contact will grow, you know, on one side, it will grow on the other side as well. You know, that's what my assumption is. And of course, we analyze this network like numerically. It can survive quite a bit of asymmetry. So if you introduce some random factors, but that violate this relationship. Of course, you can introduce a coefficient here, which would be messing up. But if the coefficient is the same for all the synapses, this will hold as well. But you can also add the asymmetric component that will survive, as hopeful network survives. All right, so let me switch over to the primacy in evolution.
Alexei, one further question.
Yeah.
Can we read about all of this stuff from your paper?
Yeah.
Okay, great, wonderful.
Not the learning stuff, though, it's in preparation.
Can you make this work if the AIJs are purely binary?
Yeah.
Because then it's easier to make the AIJs match the AJIs if they're just on-off weights.
Absolutely, yes. That's what my real thinking is, yes. There is quite a bit of information in the topology of the network, and it probably is sufficient just to have on-off synapses, but it will require some effort to show it and show what the problems are with that. Anyway, so primacy. So primacy was introduced by Dima, and I will introduce it again. But the idea is that you actually, when you recover the smell, you care only most the strongest components, of P most strongest components. So when you look at YJ, this vector yj, you care about p strongest components. That's the rough idea of primacy. Therefore, you can make decisions about smells very fast because those strongest components, they arrive very fast in the sniff cycle. So that's what Dimmerinberg had shown in his experiments. Right, so that's a somewhat crazy suggestion. Also, the representation of smells will become concentration invariant because those strongest components, they are strongest for one concentration, will be also strongest for some other concentration, because the Y vector roughly scales up.
But I think there are counterexamples to that
essentially.
Huh? I think there are counterexamples to that essentially.
Well, there are counterexamples. I think they are more limited. But I mean, the smell per set also is not constant with concentration. It's not identical with concentration. And I think counterexamples may be more limited to like weakly responding receptors. Yeah, of course, there are counterexamples. It's biology, everything is. Has hacks attached to it and matches. So, also I should say that this is a very a preliminary proposal for what primacy is, and we are still negotiating with different kind of implementations of the idea. But let's talk about.
It's taken over Dima's brain, though.
Yes. So, and mine too. So what are the constraints on receptors, right? So that's the question, on a factor receptor. And let's assume that we have two order universe. Smelliverse is two dimensional. And so we have two axes for smells, and on the axis I'm going to place binding coefficients between an odorant and a receptor. That is actually the component of the A matrix, right? So I'm going to put A1. Right, so this is for smell number one, and this is for smell number two. This is the binding coefficient.
This
right?
is one receptor type.
Yeah. No, it's not the one receptor type. It's one smell. It's smell number one. Well, I should call odorant number one.
Okay, got it.
And this is odorant number two. Okay.
No, but there's only one receptor because there's otherwise the A would have to have two indices.
Yeah, it's indices, right?
Yeah, there will be a lot of indices which are here.
J.
For the purists, I will put an index there.
Okay, so the receptor type J.
Yes.
Okay.
So receptor is a point, right? Receptor is defined by a point in this two-dimensional space.
I see.
Right?
Yes.
So there will be a bunch of J's, therefore there will be a bunch of points.
Yes.
And just generate a random set of points. Maybe not so random. Okay. So those are individual receptors. We have 1,000 of them. A lot of points. So suppose you present a smell one at certain concentration. Then there'll be a line that separates active receptors from inactive receptors. So the receptors on this side of the line will be active because their binding constants to the smell are very high. Right, so this is active domain. And these guys will be inactive. Does it make sense?
What are you thinking? The threshold nonlinearity.
Yeah, I'm assuming that it's basically a non-off model.
So the linearity has been erased. Linear equals step function for small linear.
I mean, if I, for example, threshold responses of receptors, then. So. Then, as I increase the concentration of smell, this line will sweep this plane from right to left. Because eventually, you will recruit this receptor. This receptor will be recruited first, and then this receptor, right? And then, if I postulate that the primacy parameter p equals 2, then smell number 1 will be represented by this pair of receptors.
I don't understand why the order 2 doesn't excite that receptor at all. I mean, shouldn't be that. Why is that line vertical?
Well, this is representation. All of these receptors in this model are activated by every smell. I'm just describing what the representation. If I postulate the primacy model, what will be the representation of smell number 1? And it will be represented by this duplex of receptors.
The threshold should be diagonal in this space.
Right, somehow, if order 2 kicks in, those receptors never get activated?
No, I have...
There's only order 1 now.
I have only order 1. So this is a plane, only for order 1.
It's all right.
Any more questions? Of course, there are order 2. If you have an order 2, I'll raise this just for visibility. You have another line. They're not present at the same time, though. I'm just drawing for pure order 2, right? So these guys will be active. These guys will be inactive. And as the concentration of the order 2 increases in the nose, the plane or this line will sweep in the perpendicular direction. And first it will activate this guy and this. Then it will activate this guy. And identity of order 2 in primacy model will be represented by the segment. Right. with peak of 3, it would be several. It would be probably this one as well. So the identity would be coded by a triangle, not by a signal. So then you can also have smells arriving in all possible directions, mixtures, right? So you could have plane like this. You could have plane like this, right? So as a result, you will activate this guy and this guy. Well, you activate everything, but the order identity will be represented by various order identities in primacy model of people too will be represented by 4 different segments. So this olfactory system will be able to represent 4 order identities. Right? And they actually, the order identities, they tessellate a surface or polytope of the cloud of points. Interesting thing is it's actually not convex polytope. It contains the convex polytope as a subset, and the reason why it's not convex is imagine that you would have a point right here, very close to this point, then would actually it would encode an individual order identity, and there will be additional segment, but it doesn't belong to the convex hull of the cloud of points. Does it make sense? It's actually a new mathematical object. The mathematicians I have access to, they don't recognize this as something studied.
So we're changing the threshold probably by boosting the number of receptors or something, increasing the sensitivity of the system.
Yeah, of course, you can move the points around, and that's the idea of what evolution does, probably.
Yeah.
You know?
Where does that little 7 come from?
So imagine that you just threw a set of random points on the plane, and you computed this primacy polytope by just sweeping a bunch of lines through the plane, right?
So which line would generate that second?
So it's a very good question. So imagine that you have a line which is exactly at this angle,
okay.
Right? So then it will sweep through it. It will activate. This will be the first activated. I'm sorry, my drawing is very small.
Yeah, no,
but then it will hit this guy's second.
Before
it hits those two. So you have a tiny thing representing identity of a very small segment of mixtures. You know? Which, I mean, to me, it makes this problem very exciting because it's a new mathematical object that, you know, there is a... actually has much more faces than convex polytope because it's hairy, so it has things that are sticking inside. But it also includes the convex hull as a subset, obviously. Okay. Other questions? It's probably simple enough. So, so there are 2 things that I want to say. Like, one thing is that individual order identities are represented by simplex, right? Which, in this case, it's a 2 simplex, which is a segment. But in case if p was 3, so order identity is represented by simplexes. Which are, like, for p equal 2, let's start from 2. Not to be ridiculous. You have a segment for p equal 3, you have a triangle, p equal 4, you have a tetrahedron, and so on, right? So for p equal 10, I can't even draw it. Just draw 10 points and connect them all by lines.
So let me just to rewind, so the assumptions are about the primacy, that you're assuming that the representation is by the p strongest component.
Yes.
And then everything this follows.
Yes. That is the first thing. So individual order identities becomes progressively more multidimensional as you extend p. So. Yes.
What does it actually mean? I don't. Let's say you computed the surface. I mean.
That's a good question. Let me answer.
The more complex the surface, the more different the response to mixtures is, something like this.
The more complex the surface, the more The more simplexes you have on the surface, the more other identities you can encode. So here you have like very simplistic system with four, maybe five, the one, if you accept that little thing sticking out and sticking in, you know. But another thing, this is actually...
The order identity, just to follow up, is basically ratio of the concentration, like different component, different amounts of component.
Yeah. It's the angle.
Yeah.
It's the angle in this space. This is order identity. And it can only encode as many angles. The primacy coding can encode only a discrete set of ranges of angles. So, you know. So there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other identities.
There's no constraints, there's no issue with how many receptors you put in.
Oh, there is a big issue. I don't understand anything about that, other than the number of identities bound from below by the convex hull, which I understand. This I don't understand. Here expanded by manifold. The hairiness of the surface. Actually, it's not only the only difference with convex. It actually can excite, you know, the other identities. Maybe some new polytops, some new simplexes within convex hull that are not just here. So this is a very complex and exciting question to me, and I enjoy looking at it, but I haven't really reached an understanding of how many simplexes you have in the surface, which is defined by this operational definition, basically sweeping through the space. Another issue which you may already notice is that these guys are kind of dead meat. They're completely useless, right? I mean, if indeed the system relies on encoding of smells by individual simplexes on the surface, then the guys inside the surface, they can be just eliminated, right, or pseudogenized. And that makes actually the set of receptors or responses, I think it's of receptors, very non-random, right? Once you eliminate, you get some kind of correlations between the affinity numbers. And that can be detectable, huh?
Sorry, but it's the same thing as saying that the whole responses of mitral cells after 150 milliseconds can be ignored.
Yes, it's the same thing. Yeah. Because you basically, this guy will be activated at 40 milliseconds, this guy will be activated at 50 milliseconds, and then you are done. It makes no sense to look any further.
But Dima has data that shows that you can train the animal to pay attention to things late, far late.
Yeah,
so it's not like they become irrelevant, it's that they become irrelevant for easy tasks.
That I don't know. Like for easy versus complex, I don't know. But you can also notice that although this guy encodes this particular set of order identities, as the concentration increases further, the same smell will activate, the same mixture will activate other receptors as well.
I'm not sure if the analogy is true, right? Because in the Niemann's mitral cells, it's not that those mitral cells are never activated, right? They can be activated by others.
Yes.
He's talking about the set of odorants receptors which never in the whole space get activated, right?
There's a set of receptors.
So here, there's the
never
point
where,
like,
they don't exist. They're just eliminated. Because there is no evolutionary process. It is that evolution really cares about that couple. Like if there is a signal.
They're never first.
Right. But and so those are actually retained, right? But these guys, they basically get destroyed by drift or whatever.
Right. Unless you want to code for concentration, right? If you really want to code for which odor, that's correct. If you want to code for concentration, at high concentration, you need this.
Yeah. Unless you use timing code for concentration.
Yeah.
Such as
when
the time when you hit these guys in the order in the sniff cycle. Or, excuse me?
The brain doesn't use timing code.
We're going to ignore Peter's
Somebody's got to say it.
No, I mean, I agree that, I mean, there are a lot of problems, like, but the concentration, in this scheme, the concentration encoding, you basically get the concentration from responses of those neurons. I mean, those neurons, you have the Ys, right? If you have the firing rates of those neurons, you can figure out what the concentration is. So it's not really...
So that would predict that every receptor type is high affinity for something.
Sorry.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. And that's a testable prediction.
But is that even surprising? We'd expect that every receptor is high affinity.
Exactly. So you need to You basically are following my like two sentences in my subsequent presentation.
No,
exactly replicated. I don't know. Do you guys want to go out and hear give this talk?
That's very predictable. Sorry. Yes.
I'm very predictable.
All
right. So how do we test this?
Cool.
So you.
You also had a train of thought before we interrupted, something about the correlations, right?
Yeah.
Non-random, and you said...
Exactly, that's how you test it, right?
Oh, okay, I see.
By correlations. I mean, of course, there is for every smell, there is a receptor that was activated first. So the idea would be to... So imagine you have a matrix, the ground matrix of receptors from 1 to 1,000, and then smells. I'm not going to distinguish, for the purposes of this talk, smell, odor, and odorant, although I understand the distinction. Just odorant is too low. Odorant would be the best fitting term.
So you're barely talking about chemicals here, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about chemicals. So actually, in a minute I'm going to switch. So I'm going to use the ambiguity of this term. Anyway, So you have smells, which are a lot of potential smells that you have there, mixtures included, right? And then you have this matrix, which is matrix of responses, right? So what you do is like you for every smell, so these are the set of responses to a given smell. You find peak topmost.
What?
P, topmost responses. You sort them, so you sort this vector, and you find P largest, right? And you put ones there. And you put, so this would be P equal 4 model with tetrahedrons. Individual smell identity would be a tetrahedron. So, and the rest are zeros. So then you do it for all the smells that you can measure. You'd have some kind of random set of ones. And then you would have something like this. Or let me draw it here, actually. You would have three components matching and one different. So you have three matching components. So the idea that if you have indeed primacy coding, then you expect to have more of such coincidences than at random. And the reason why is because the simplexes, they tessellate the surface. So for every simplex, you will find the nearest neighbor simplex. And then you will find actually a lot of those nearest neighbors because it's a surface, right? They're not just randomly drawn from a random distribution. So the prediction of the primacy model is by virtue of having this primacy polytope, which is a continuous surface, you expect to have more nearest neighbors or simplexes that share a phase, say a low-dimensional phase, than at random.
I did not understand that reasoning at all.
Okay, I'll try to repeat it. I mean, I don't know.
Wait, I'm going to get smarter.
That's a very...
Maybe you would do the 3 rather than 4. P of 4. P
two, right.
We have 3 better than...
2, maybe.
Maybe 1.
Yeah, well, that was the correlation. Even 1, it should actually also hold, right? Okay, we got pizza for lunch.
So, if you have the same 6 cells, I guess if you connect them by random triangles, if you like draw random triangles through, you would expect much fewer of the fraction.
So.
But you're saying these are decorrelated, so you wouldn't expect many like this.
you wouldn't expect many nearest neighbors as in a random.
I mean, because you made the selection, right? I mean, you started with random and then you chose evolution or whatever, otherwise, and you now have a surface rather than.
Yeah. But you select the same number of triangles.
You select the same number of triangles
as you have in the matrix, randomly from the same set of preceptors. You would expect the number of nearest neighbors, because you'll get all sorts of triangles that are not.
Because you're dealing with a surface and a space, you reduce the dimensionality and therefore up the probability of sharing.
That's right.
Send the answers. Did you check this?
Well, I did, but we have only data for 2DEG from Michael Leon.
No, but I was trying
to. That is a difficult data set to handle.
So in 2D, you've got from 2D to 1D. Sorry, Vijay. In ND, you got for N to N minus 1. How big an effect is that?
N minus 1, what?
So here, you know, the picture is you got from 2D to 1D, right? And that's a big change. In reality, you're going from 1,000 dimensions to 999. And that's a much smaller change, so I'm not at all convinced by it. You can see some equations before I buy this.
I guess you raise a very important question, which is that if the smell dimension, I assume that the dimensionality of the smell space is less than the number of receptors. So I'm existing in this kind of segment of theories that I have two dimensions and say 10 receptors, or I have, say, 20 dimensions and 1,000 receptors. And if the number of dimensions in the smell space is smaller.
So if you tell me smells are massively correlated, that makes much more sense.
Smells are more correlated?
That's basically what you said, right? If it smells in the much lower dimension of the receptor space, that makes them massively correlated. Like they live in low D space and.
Right, but even like if you threw random points in low dimensional space, they would be less, they would still be uncorrelated.
I need to see some equations, I'm not buying this.
So actually we've been doing a bunch of analyses of correlations and response matrices for not unrelated reasons to look for signatures of selection.
Yeah.
For either for orders or
for Drosophila, of course.
Or for randomness and you know what's it being selected for. So that's a clearly great idea. And definitely there are significant correlations that go beyond. It's not random, that's for sure.
Yeah, but the correlations are very higher order than you would just.
You could get higher order correlation. You know, there's higher order structure for sure in that. So now consider this alternate hypothesis, right? That the reason that they exist, that these correlations exist, and they're definitely there, along the lines of what.
So you think about it in terms.
Well, I mean, if you look at the sensing matrices, you know, cut this in any way you want, whether you do it via primacy or via intensity, you know, firing rate of response, do whatever you like to write down the matrix of that. You find correlations and you find them significant and you find them more than random and you find multi-point correlations and you find all of these things. So suppose I say that the reason why these correlations exist is, well, how does evolution happen? You know, you get gene duplication followed by variation. And when you do that, you know, they're just. The receptors don't become that different from each other very quickly. So it's just the process, the dynamics by which you make these things. And evolution is a, you know, it's a work in progress anyway.
So it's fully evolved, is what you meant.
Oh, yeah, but you're not nearly fully evolved.
Excuse me, BJ.
With the exception of you, who are an enlightened individual. Right? So what if I say that these correlations are just a consequence of the fact that, well, you know, can't help them.
I mean, if you assume that stuff is imperfect, it's difficult for me to argue with you.
Well, that's a problem for us, too. The reason why, well, I'm not trying to argue, right? It's a problem for our analyses, too.
Yeah.
And it's something that, as theorists, we, of course, always struggle with, right? So I'm wondering if you have a useful insight for reviewer number 3 when they come along.
Well, maybe we'll discuss it later. I mean, that's a great question.
Actually, I was just looking at, you know, if you want to finish 11:30-ish, how much you want to get to the duality.
Yeah. Questions? Let me ask one more question now. I'll talk about duality, which is cool, I think. But completely, it will evoke more questions.
This is cool, too.
I think it's a really nice way to think of the system.
Well, thank you.
It's really cool, too.
So now, for the duality part, actually the principal thing would be, for me, this matrix of zeros and ones, which I call SPI, with S standing for simplex, right, because it contains simplexes. And of course, I'm going to argue that piriform cortex encodes those. responses of piriform cortical neurons are those simplexes, right? So that would be my goal. And as P stands for smell identity, which I think is a redundant. Right now, instead of individual smells like mixtures, I will be talking about identities, right? So this would be an individual identity, and I would stand for receptor.
And
we call it actually J to be more consistent.
And simplex again here means you take your, let's say P equals 3, then you take the 3 most active.
Question?
Yeah, maybe for the previous part. So if you look at these correlations, you could, in principle, try to infer the P from the matrix?
I mean, we tried that. And what happens is that the number of nearest neighbors just compared, normalized by in random resampling, will just go up as a function of P. Like for reasonable P's for up to 10. I think like from some back of the envelope estimations from Dimas data, we get P around 15. You know, but we haven't tested to that point yet because it takes a lot of actually time to crank the algorithm. Also, data is very questionable. That's why I don't report it. I mean, it's basically 2DG data. Of Mike Leon, that's the only data set that we have. So P, to answer your question, I don't know how to infer P. And for P's that we looked at for some data which looks like real, up to 10, the number of nearest neighbors is larger than for, for randomly reshuffled. So another thing, I also need to say another thing, which is as a disclaimer for the next part, is that so this is my simplex that encodes order identity. Let's suppose that this is my simplex. So I'm going to argue that those different P's are actually not the entire simplex, but maybe subsimplexes. So if this is like the primary simplex, maybe different P's are the faces of the primary simplex, or as we call them, subprime simplexes. The reason why I'm going to tell that is because I'm going to tell you that individual piriform cortical cells, they'll be encoding those simplexes. And I know that there is one more than one, to every smell, there is more than one cell responding. So if we postulated that piriform cortical cell responds to the primary simplex, then I would have only one grandmother cell active in the piriform cortex. Right, so I need to argue that there will be many cells active in piriform cortex, and they will be encoding, for example, six segments, six edges of the primary simplex. Okay, all right. So this matrix S, which contains zeros and ones, will encode subprime simplexes. But if I collect them together, I can collect the primary simplex. Okay. Make sense? All right, so then what is the duality thing? So suppose, it's a general, very general idea. I don't know, I can't find much mentioning it. Maybe you will point me in the right direction. But the idea is this, that what the neural system is doing is trying to, well, sensory systems, they're trying to figure out X. Given the responses of neurons, say in retina or in olfactory bulb. Right? So they actually try to figure out X using some kind of parsimony constraint. So the simplest version of X, given some constraints. So it basically becomes sort of Lagrangian problem, right? So you have some functional to minimize, such as measure of X, given a set of conditions. So how do we optimize it? And so there is an optimization theory, there is a duality theory, which I'm going to mention now. Unfortunately, I don't have much time to spend like really introducing duality theory. But I'm sure that many of you know it much better than I. You know, so the idea is that suppose you need to find the minimum of a function. Given a set of constraints, such as h, I of x, bigger or equal than zero. So these are inequality constraints. So in physics, people usually use the equality constraints, and then they have Lagrange coefficients. life is not so easy if you have an equality constraint. Right, so therefore you have dual formulations that I'll mention, right? So then you still can define a Lagrangian, it turns out. So you define a Lagrangian L of X and a set of Lagrange coefficients that I'll call alpha, which is equal to F of X minus the sum of Lagrange coefficients. Let me call actually this P to make life easier for me, alpha P HP of X, sum over P. So this is called primal problem. Right, then you go to something called dual problem, and that's the first step in that direction is to define like the Lagrangian.
So, Alex, have you read Cianciuttini and Mattia Langle's Nips paper?
No.
They did this for insect
practices. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Okay. Yes, and they did it not in KKT case. They did it for equality.
Okay.
And there are important differences.
Okay.
So. I'm impressed, actually. Anyway, so I should have mentioned that paper. Yes. So then you define a dual function, which is called, let's call it theta, which only depends on alpha, which is actually a minimum over x of L of x alpha, right? And then you And the minimum is found without constraints. That's the beauty of the Lagrange idea, that you don't need to have constraints. You can just compute the derivative, and you'll find the minimum. Right? So there's no constraints in finding this minimum. Right? So then you find x star, which is the point of the minimum. And then you have theta. It turns out that theta is actually a concave function of alpha. If f is convex, and this is convex, then theta is concave. So you find its maximum. So alpha is equal to arch max of theta of alpha, under the constraint that alpha p is bigger or equal than zero. So this would be your alpha star, which is the optimum value of alpha. And this is called the dual problem. So there's no axis in the dual problem. It's just basically a function. It's a problem for Lagrange coefficients alphas, which probably are not called Lagrange coefficients. It's not. But you know, the idea is that once you find this alpha star, you can plug it back into x, and then you will find the optimal x. So by solving the dual problem, you also solve the primal problem. The convenience of the dual problem is to have much simpler constraints. Just have like non-negativity constraints, as opposed to something more complex here, which may be some linear relationship or something more convoluted. So this is actually much simpler to implement. But for the nervous system, it's actually beautiful, because if alphas are responses of neurons, right, the response of neurons, firing rates of neurons are positive. And it's fantastic. So because you don't need to worry about it. I mean, the reason it's fantastic is because you have it, you have this constraint for free, right? Also, another thing is that because you have this non-negativity constraint, you have a hard boundary on alphas. So a lot of alphas will be on that boundary. So as a result, the response of neurons will be very sparse, which is also kind of a desirable feature because it's something that is observed. So I'm going to implement it now. I don't really have time like to go into a lot of examples for introducing this duality theory.
Tell us how it works in a fraction.
I'll basically very briefly in the next 10 minutes describe you, and then maybe you will ask me questions later. So now the primacy is that one constraint, because you know that there are guys that are more active than others, right? So it's an inequality constraint. So we'll use this matrix X to formulate them, right? So we'll say that, so you have a set of P's which are primary. I'm not talking about nervous system now. I'm just looking at the responses, and I found P primary segments, right? I found P combinations that are larger than others, right? So I'm going to say that for P belonging to primary set, the sum of yj spj is bigger than some threshold epsilon. And for the rest of receptors, the same sign is less than epsilon.
So SPJ was that matrix you just erased, right?
Right. It basically contains all the information about what receptors are included in individual other percepts. Right. So I'm saying that it's basically a channel. If I look at this channel corresponding to individual other identity, and I sum all the y's in that channel, I will get something bigger than epsilon. And for all other channels, I'll get something which is smaller than epsilon. And the reason why I need to introduce epsilon is because, I mean, the problem is non-parametric, right? So it's formulated as inequalities, but I need to write network equations. So I need to go from non-parametric formulation to something real that has real numbers in it. That's why I introduced this constant epsilon so that...
So,
you know what I mean? Because inequalities, they don't fix the scale. I need to fix the scale somewhere in my network. Yes?
Your capital P is a function of X, or...
So there is this matrix S that I'm looking at, my grand lookup table, which contains a bunch of simplexes. And I just look at all those simplexes, and I find that for some set of those simplexes, this condition holds. And, you know, for others, it doesn't hold. That's my information.
I mean, the set P of the primary indices, that's the function of the stimulus, right?
It's basically for... Yes. There should be a lookup table for P's, right? So
right.
If I know that there is a certain combination of certain simplexes corresponds to certain other identity, so P is actually other identity, the large P.
Okay. So you can use S to infer the P's.
Yes. So P is other identity.
Mm-hmm.
And little p is these sub-simplexes, whatever you call
them. Yeah, sub-simplexes, which I need to introduce as a hack, actually, to have many neurons responding. I could have a single simplex.
And yj is increasing with time, so this is going to be satisfied for some brief period of time, then it won't be satisfied, right?
Yeah. Actually, right now, I'm talking about sort of math problem, and I'm going to map it on network problem in the next 10 minutes. Okay. So maybe five.
Started late.
So
we'll give him 5 extra.
I'm giving myself 15 extra minutes. So okay, so now the Lagrangian L of X and alpha will be I'll just use L2 norm. Reason being is that I haven't made much progress. I mean, we have made some progress, but I don't have complete understanding with L1 norm. Minus, right, so that's my function which I optimize, f of x. And then there is minus the set of constraints, alpha p. I actually can collapse those two constraints into one. I can say that the sum
sine function
over j s p j yj minus epsilon times some coefficient up is bigger or equal than zero, and that will, and up is equal to plus one for p belonging to the primary set and minus one for p not belonging to primary set. Right, so then I have one condition, so I can write Lagrangian UP SP J YJ minus epsilon.
This is looking a lot like hinge loss, right?
Like what?
Hinge loss.
Hinge loss.
Standard. That's what web machines.
It is a very resemblance of support vector machines, but it's not.
Yes.
I mean, because KKT theory is used in support vector machines, but it's. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So. Now I need to go to the dual problem. So I differentiate over x, at dl over dx equals 0 will give me x. So x will be equal to xi, will be equal to sum over p's, alpha p, yp, spi, spj, aji, sum over j.
So yj equals aji xj.
Excuse me?
Yj equals a.
Right. So yj is equal to the sum over I, aji, xi. Sorry, yes. And then I call this, which is the product of S matrix by A matrix, as VPI, just matrix, which is a result from matrix product. So if I know alphas, I can find x's. It's similar to this condition. Right. But then the most interesting is the dual problem. The dual problem, dual functional, which is a function of alpha, is basically this. So it's epsilon sum over alpha over p, alpha p up, minus 1/2 sum over ps, alpha p, alpha s, up, us, sum over I, v, p, I, v, s, I. Basically how similar individual simplexes are. So,
so wait, where did that first term come from?
Comes from this. It's just this thing, really.
Oh, okay.
Because it doesn't contain x.
What about the xi squared?
Right. Remember, you need to maximize this.
Oh, I see.
So I can actually make a Lyapunov function of this by flipping it over. So if I say that there is a Lyapunov function of alpha that is equal to minus theta of alpha, then I have a network, as I got for the granule cells. And the network is inhibitory. And the strength of inhibition is controlled by the overlap, by similarity between those matrices V. Right? So this is like, I think in machine learning terms, this is a kernel. It actually can be kernelized, which is the beauty of it. You don't have to, it doesn't depend on the individual components of smelts, which are eyes. It just depends on how similar the simplexes are. So how similar are responses of two simplexes to a bunch of smells? You don't need to know individual components.
And so you want to realize this in the inhibitory network in cortex?
Right. So the idea is that it's inhibitory network in cortex. And I'll just draw out the network for you as a conclusion.
Pyramidal cells are there for...
Pardon?
...the destructor.
Excuse me?
The pyramidal cells in cortex are a destructor.
I think that, I mean, I'm suggesting that pyramidal cells actually implement this. So the idea is that you have Ys, the first layer of the network are the receptors, YJs, and then you have those U things, which are plus minus one, which are binary. And the Us, so alphas are responses of pyramidal neurons, so they would be non-negative. So U's are the inputs. If U is positive, it actually makes sense for alpha to become positive. Because you are maximizing this thing, to maximize it. So this is actually a drive of individual pyramidal neurons. So UP, it receives inputs from Ys, which are contained in this S J matrix. And once a given component is receives anomalous inputs, it turns into plus one. And I don't know what those cells are, or if they have any relevance to cells at all. But they actually
pluses, right?
Huh?
So how big are these matrices? What's the dimensionality of P?
This is number of simplexes, which is the number of cells in the cortex. Like 200,000.
Aren't there a lot more than that simplexes? It depends for P equals 4, aren't there? How many simplexes are there for P equals 4? Is that sort of, I mean, it's less than N choose 4. It's 1,000 choose 4 if they were uncorrelated, right?
Well, but you have this surface. You actually eliminate a bunch of simplexes, which I never used. So I don't know. I mean, that's a question which I don't know the answer to, because I don't know how many simplexes are in this primacy polytop. You know, really. But let me finish. So you have them driving your alpha cells. And the alpha T cells, they actually inhibit each other. Well, they interact with each other with this kernel VPS. The relevant interactions are mostly inhibitory. So basically, that's what the kind of structure that you derive from this primacy theory. I guess the beauty of the duality theory, I guess the beauty of this is that alphas, if you implement it with neurons, alphas are constrained to be positive because the firing rates of neurons can fall below zero. And also, you can find a network with inhibitory interactions that will maximize that functional for free. As I explained to you, like with the granule cells, you know, it's straightforward just to find this network. And here's the question.
So I should think of here as Y as being the bulb input to cortex.
Yes.
And alpha are the pyramidal cells, VPS is the effective inhibitory network I get through the through interneurons in cortex.
Yes.
And the U are some effective, you know.
U would be some kind of highly nonlinear neuron in the piriform cortex, but I'm not really. I cannot really map it directly onto. Maybe some input current.
Semi-lunar.
I don't know.
They don't project the parameters.
Just as an announcement, you can do it very easily. You can do it very easily. But just as to provoke you even more, you also have those constraints that X, that elements of X, this X, has to be positive. Right? Because those are real concentrations, right? So to this Lagrangian, you have to actually add another set of constraints, which is controlled by another set of coefficients, Lagrange coefficients, beta i's, which will enforce the positivity of x's. And for those beta i's, you actually get some topology which is very resemblant of granule cells. So you would get another set of cells or variables, beta i's, which receive excitatory inputs from alpha p's, so they're actually coupled with alphas, but they inhibit y's, and then y's they drive the u's. So that's basically, if you finish this, if I was able to finish this presentation, I would describe to you that betas actually can be implemented in a network like this, and whether it's granule cells or not. But then the role of betas is to enforce that X's are positive or non-negative. Sorry, guys, I ran over time. I really apologize for this. You know.
That's okay. We can meet up again in the afternoon. Right?
Absolutely. It's very interesting.
Yeah. I can show you more calculations.
But maybe we should first thank Alexei and everyone.